slow.
That was a cool thing about the 80s, you know, like all those movies were like that.
Every one of my games, I try to do something brand new.
Best time to get someone, man, when they're well fed and had a couple of wines. Welcome to the Retro Project Podcast. My name is Steve and I am your host. Now, today's guest on the show is Mr. Warren Robinette. Now, Warren is the programmer of possibly my favourite game of all time, Atari's Adventure. He is also responsible for programming a few other games as well. And if you've enjoyed the show so far, I really, really think you're going to enjoy these episodes coming up where we speak to Warren. Now, Warren is going to be with us in just one moment. But before that, I would like to let you know where you can find us. You can find us on the Twitter at Retro Project Pod. You can find us on Facebook at Retro Project Pod. And you can send us an email to theretroprojectpod@gmail.com. If you'd love to send us some feedback, please do. We would love to hear from you. You can also find any of our episodes on iTunes, so head over to iTunes, dip into the back catalogue, and while you're there, if you'd like to leave us a review, honestly, it really, really does help the show out, and we really, really do appreciate it. So that's enough for me. So now, Mr. Warren Robinette. It's like, why don't we just start at the beginning?
Okay.
Where were you born? Where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Springfield, Missouri in 1951. In the American Midwest, had a really great little nuclear family. Later in my life, I gave my mother a certificate of sainthood, which she was a nice Baptist lady, and it was from a pretty weird little church that you could pay $5 to become a minister in, but she accepted it as the compliment it was meant to be. I had three siblings. I was the eldest. Went to college in Texas at Rice University, a pretty good university. Had a great time in college. Thought I was going to Vietnam when I graduated because the war was going on.
Yep.
Didn't take any stupid, boring stuff. I only took cool stuff because I thought I was going to be in the jungle subsequent to those courses. So I ended up with a crazy major. All existing majors wanted me to focus too much on one thing. So my major at Rice was an area major where you got to just plug a bunch of things together. So it was a combination of linguistics, math, and art called Computer Applications to Language and Art. And if you think about it, that was a pretty good preparation for a career that didn't even exist yet. Namely, being a video game designer.
So, what year was it that you were at uni? When did you start at Rice?
1970 through 1974.
There was no video game industry at that point, and obviously, that's what you're very well known for.
Well, Atari was founded in 1972, so there was a very small coin op industry in its nascent stages.
Yeah,
but there wasn't much.
You were born on Christmas Day, weren't you?
Yeah, that's right.
You're a Christmas baby.
And I'm going to tell you an interesting statistic, Steve. Roughly one out of every 365 people is born on Christmas.
365. Well, yeah, I almost got pulled in by that one as well. No, I almost got pulled in by that one as well. I'm sitting there going, "Wow, I wonder how that actually equates as far as the rest of the year goes."
Well, look, see that. Let me tell you something. That failed joke, kind of jokes that nerds tell. Did you know that?
Yeah, and it's the kind of joke that other nerds laugh at as well, like I am. So I mean,
be a test for yours.
The certificate of sainthood. That must almost be every mother's dream to actually receive that.
Well, yeah, it was a compliment. She liked it. We have a picture of her. Me and my two brothers gave her the certificate of sainthood. It was a long time ago, 30 years ago, but she was smiling. She liked it.
Yeah. So you're the oldest out of three boys.
I'm the oldest out of three boys and one girl.
And one girl. Oh, so there's... You actually, when you said nuclear family, you like it is actually a fairly large family that you came from.
Well, it was an average-sized family in the 50s, four kids. I'm 66, so I may be a little bit older than you, but I would say that four was typical in the 50s, at least when I grew up in Missouri.
I've got two kids, and the idea of having four just sends my brain into overdrive.
So I have three sons, so I know what you're saying. Once you sort of think you've brought it to some sort of completion, you don't really want to start over.
Yeah.
At the same time, you don't want to send any of them back either. Most days.
Some days.
Yeah. How old are your kids?
12 and 10.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so...
Well, I have three sons who are 24, 22, and 17.
And have any of them got an interest in computers the way that you do? Are they...
Well, they all three play video games constantly. My eldest just got a job as a software engineer, so I guess that would be a yes.
Yeah.
My middle son is a student. Have you heard of McGill University in Montreal? Both my two eldest boys. Well, I married a Canadian, so my sons are dual national American Canadian. Those silly socialists up in Canada subsidize the education of their citizens, unlike America.
They're ruining the world, aren't they? They really are with that kind of crazy behavior.
Oh, Trump. Oh, God, yeah. Don't get me started. he's destroying so many things so fast. Trump, in my opinion, is a wannabe dictator. And there is no guarantee that American democracy is going to survive this crisis. I hope it does, but we'll see.
It's a pretty strong system that you've got in place. I think it'll take more than, you know, a childish buffoon to come in and destroy the whole thing. There'll be some work which will have to be done. Like, you know, I think that's kind of...
I think it's teetering on... American democracy is teetering on the edge of failure right now. It could go either way. Most people are incapable of conceiving that something that's existed for 240 years could just suddenly fail. But I am not incapable of conceiving that, and I am scared. I actually spent a significant fraction of the last year and a half creating an algorithm to draw fair voting districts. I didn't work on it full time, but it took me a year and a half, starting from around the time Trump got elected. And all I have to do is get these nine judges to approve it. And what I have found is that nobody will listen to me. I tried to contact a lot of politicians and lawyers, and they're not interested. A few of them have listened to me, but they've told me that no algorithm will ever be accepted as a means of solving the gerrymandering problem. So,
you're also from an era like from before Watergate, when the politicians were viewed as, you know, respectful as and respected. You know, there was a certain statesman.
Well, that's right. I was a college student when Nixon was doing his dirty tricks.
That must seem like an absolute trip at the time, the idea that the U.S. president was acting in such a way.
Well, to tell you the truth, I was more interested in the possibility that I would get my own personal sweet little ass shot full of holes in Vietnam. The way it worked back then is everybody had to sign up for the draft, but if you were a college student, you got a four-year deferment. And then after the 4 years, you had to go and join the service.
Yep.
If war was still going on. But luckily enough for me, the war ended just a few months before I graduated from college. So the whole time I was in college, I expected to go to Vietnam when I finished, but then I didn't. Didn't have to.
You're there, you're doing a college degree. You're basically working towards your future. But one of the first things you may have to do when you leave is head off to war.
Yeah, well, that was the situation. I was trying to tell you earlier, it's why I took art courses, and I took what I was interested in, not anything, quote, practical.
Yep.
I wasn't really oriented towards I had no career plan or anything. I've always been kind of interest motivated. So taking whatever I pleased fit right in with my personality, and then I found a way to tie it all together into a package, I told you earlier.
Yep.
Computer applications, language and art. It worked out pretty well, actually.
So you leave college. What was it like to go out after college with this degree and then say, well, what am I going to do? Where am I going to go?
Well, I don't think I was all that different than a lot of people graduating from college. I got out of college. My father wasn't giving me any money on a per-month basis anymore, so my money ran out pretty quickly, and I got a job. Okay. So I got a job as a Fortran programmer at a company in Houston. I'd gone to college in Houston.
Yep.
Company was called Western Geophysical. My job was to help keep track of where Western ships were in the oceans of the world. These ships would go out and make little boom booms as they cruised around the oceans, and then they had these geophones that would collect the echoes of the boom booms coming back up from the ocean floor, and they could bring the tapes with the recordings of the returning echoes and analyze them and actually locate, they could map the reflective strata beneath the ocean floor and locate the salt domes and other geological structures. They could actually figure out where the oil was out there underneath the ocean floor. So I was in the navigation department, and our job was just to keep track of where the ships were when they were making their loud noises, so that if they found something interesting, they could go back to that exact same latitude and longitude.
Well,
anyway, that was my first job, Fortran programmer,
yep.
Dealing with the data that came back from those ships. And it wasn't easy, but it that did not quite match the profile of the... I'm not sure that I had an ideal job in mind, but have you ever heard of a song called the I Don't Know What I Want, But I Ain't Getting It Blues?
No. But it sounds like what you're talking
well,
about.
Well, there is no such song, but it's a joke. It's a joke song title, all right? But I applied to graduate school 1 month after starting that job. I knew I had to get a job, and I worked there for about a year, but it wasn't what I wanted to spend 40 years doing,
yeah.
Let's say.
I'm actually glad that I didn't turn around and say, oh, yeah, I know that song. It's one of my favorites.
Good move. Well, I guess you probably want to get to Atari before we finish talk. So far we're going in chronological order. That's okay.
We can go anywhere you want.
Well, I don't have much of an agenda. I'm laying here with three glasses of wine in me.
There's rarely a job after the third.
But I think you'd be frustrated if I ran out of steam before we got to Atari.
Let's have a chat about that then. One of the things you're most famous for is the Easter egg. The adventure Easter egg. Now, that's been thrown out into pop culture very recently with Ready Player One. As a kid of the 80s, I was born in 74. I got my first Atari when I was 7 years old, and Adventure was one of the cartridges that was in it. And I played that game and still play it because of the randomness to it, which was a brilliant move on your part as well with Game 3. The randomness to it makes it possible to still be playing this game all of these years later. You know the basic mechanics of it, but you've no idea where anything's going to be. And then in the movie, at the end of the movie, the Easter egg is the key to the whole thing, which made perfect sense when they're searching for Easter eggs, and yours is the crown, the chalice, I suppose we could call it. When that happened, were you approached about it? Were there conversations with you about it? Or was it something where someone said to you, look, this is just something that's happening. We hope you enjoy it.
Well, what happened was, so I've gotten to know Ernie Cline. I'd say he's a friend of mine now. The way I met him was Ready Player One, the book, was published like 7 years ago. And about 4 years ago, he was coming to my town where I live, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, to do a book signing at a bookstore here in town. Chapel Hill is a college town. We're the University of North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Ernie emailed me, and I had recently heard about Ready Player One, the book, from a friend of mine. So I can be sort of out of touch sometimes, but in this particular instance, I was aware of that book that had mentioned adventure and used it in the plot. So Ernie and I had lunch, and we sort of liked each other. And so then when I was in Austin, Texas, where he lives, a year later, we had lunch again. So we get to know each other a bit. And so a slightly earlier part of the backstory is Ernie was 8 years old. He's about the same age as you, 8 years old in 1980. And he got adventure. He played it at home. He found the secret room on his own and got into the secret room where it says created by Warren Robinette. He recognized, even though he was eight, he recognized it for what it was, which it was a message from the creator of the game.
Mm.
Right. And so it kind of blew his mind. And then you just kind of have to wait 30 years because it blew his mind, but he was eight. And so he did a lot of things in those 30 years, but he became a science fiction writer, and he was working on this game, and he decided to use the idea of an Easter egg in the plot for Ready Player One. Of course, you've read the book,
seen the
movie, so you know how he did that. And he not only chose to use the idea of an Easter egg, but he decided to use the particular game, Adventure, the one that blew his mind in particular, in his book, and then it got put into the movie too. And here's the reason that you saw what you saw in that movie. Ernie had done a previous screenplay for a movie. It was called Fanboys. And the rules, I think it's union rules of writers and actors and so forth. You know, Hollywood is kind of a unionized operation.
Yep.
And so the rules of the game were that because he was a blooded screenwriter, not just your ordinary dickhead novelist, but he was an actual screenwriter too, with his name on the credit of a real movie. That gave him a seat at the table when the screenplay was being written for Ready Player One, the movie. And it was a big deal movie, you know, it doesn't get any bigger than Steven Spielberg directing, but Ernie had the right to be there. And there was another guy, I think, named Zach Penn, who was probably a more eminent type of screenwriter, but Ernie was there too. And what he told me at one of these lunches was, I fought to keep your name in the script. Okay. And he also got me tickets to the premiere in LA, which is last March. So when he told me I fought to keep your name in the script, I thought it might have said Robinette one time, and it might or might not survive the editing process. So I was sort of prepared myself to not be too disappointed if it didn't actually happen. And then when I was sitting there at the Dolby Theater on Hollywood Boulevard with all Hollywood people, I was pretty surprised at the end to see they said my full name three times. And that's what Ernie meant by I fought to keep your name in the script. It wouldn't have happened if he hadn't been there and been one of the screenwriters, in my opinion.
With anything in life, you pick your fights.
Yeah.
Good on him for fighting for that, because for someone like me, that was a key part of the film. If your name hadn't have been there, just say it had come up with different letters and it had said, you know, Easter egg or congratulations, player one, or whatever, the authenticness of it just wouldn't have been there.
Well, I think what you just described is what would normally happen.
Yeah.
But
yeah, for sure.
Life is kind of weird. So
yeah.
Well, and so, you know, it's funny how these things echo one from the other. You know what was my inspiration for putting a secret message in my game?
The official story that I've read is that Atari wasn't crediting anyone at the time for their games, and there was no names on the covers or the game or anything like that, and that was your way of getting credit for the game. But is that the real story?
True. What I was getting ready to tell you was what gave me the inspiration to hide a secret message in the game, because maybe it seems sort of obvious in retrospect that you could hide a secret message in a game, but nobody had done it before that. So it occurred to me that I could, you know, I was making this adventure game that had it had 30 different rooms in the end. So it had a bunch of different places. Some of them were hard to get to, and I was a programmer. I could control how hard it was to get to different places. I could create obstacles, right? I could make doors that had keys. I could make you go through as many doors as I wanted with as many keys hidden as the hard of places as I could imagine. So it was up to me to modulate how hard it was to get to the key, to get to the secret room. So my model was, you may not be old enough to remember this, but when I was a teenager back in the 60s, there was this rumor about Paul McCartney was dead. And then somebody played a Beatle record and thought they heard that it's backwards, and they thought they heard it saying, "I buried Paul."
Okay. I do remember the Abbey Road and so, cover. People taking the fact that one of them was barefoot, yeah, and the pallbearers and all that. I do remember that.
Yeah,
story.
Well, that was part of the whole thing. Paul McCartney disappeared from the public view for months. People said he was dead. They were playing every Beatle record backwards, searching for secret messages. So that's what I thought of when I put my own secret message into my video game. So you see, what the Beatles did back in the late 60s, this was 10 years later when I put a secret message into my video game. So, and then 30 years later, Ernie put the idea of an Easter egg into Ready Player One. So you see these things kind of echo over long periods of time. It gets into somebody's head and it sits there and ferments or something for a decade or three decades, and then it germinates.
It was something that as I said to you before, I played this game to death, even to the point where my friends and I used to go out and we used to set up Real Life Adventure where we lived, because we lived in a street that had a park in the middle of it, and we had a crappy yellow plastic cup, and one of us would hide it.
Oh, somewhere. You told me that in your email.
Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty funny.
And
what did you do with the yellow cup?
One of my friends still has it on display.
You mean whoever won the game that day got the yellow cup?
We got to keep it. Now, of course, there was a day where it was the last day that we got to play it, because one of the guys was moving out of our street, which meant that the band was, mm-hmm, was about to break up. So we played it. And the guy who moved out of the street is the guy who won that day. Refused to give
so
up
he
the
kept
cup,
it.
And he took the cup with him. And every now and again, I'll just get a random, sometimes at like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, I'll just get a random photo sent to my phone of this crappy yellow plastic cup sitting in a trophy case, and he's had a wooden base made for it, and a plaque, and the plaque says "Ultimate Adventurer," and it's still there. And we've always said there's going to be a day when we're all together, and we're going to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Even as 44-year-old men, we are going to hide it in the street somewhere. We're going to go back to the original place. It hasn't happened yet, but it's come close a couple of times where there've been all of us except for one. There's always been a combination of all of us, but never all of us.
So the game you were playing, you weren't playing Adventure on the 2600. You were playing a version of it
outside
on the street.
It was almost like it was almost like a real, like we had one of us was the cube. We had, because there were enough of us, so one of us could be the cube. We had the three dragons, and one of us would would be the bat.
Okay.
The point of the bat was basically if the bat saw that you had something, called, you know, we had swords, because they swords back in that day. It was a broom handle.
So you acted it out.
Yeah, and I tell you what, we played that game for years, and it was because we played it on the 2600. You know, I don't know if you know, people weren't around for the 2600 would realize the importance of the open world that you created. That was something that we didn't get back in those days. We'd get one screen. You'd have Pac-Man on a screen. You'd have like Galaga on a screen. You'd have waves, and you would have variations, but you didn't have an open world, which is something that's taken for granted today. And we realized one day that we've got an open world outside. We can do this as a game. And there would there'd always be someone who would be the bat, and if you got something, he would literally come up, and if he tagged you, you had to give what you had to the bat, and he would go off and hide it somewhere. And it was a lot of fun, and that game wouldn't have existed. Like, and that's a huge part of my childhood, probably as much as the Atari in general is. But that's a game that I've got friends who we still talk about it today. And one day I'm going to get this crappy yellow plastic cup. I'm going to get it back.
Play. I'll tell you something. I was into it when I was working on my games at Atari, but I didn't really realize how much impact it was going to have. You know, there's about a dozen people designing games at Atari. Each game was a one person, one game type of situation, because the memories were so tiny.
Yeah, yeah.
It was pretty hard to make one of those games. You had to be a good programmer, and you had to have a good idea, and it helped if you were decent at the art side of it, which that was not really my strong point. People told me the dragons looked like ducks, but still, in that case, I think I came out with a pretty good end product. I worked very hard at it, and also I did not get no encouragement from my boss at Atari, but I got active discouragement. You probably know that part of the story, right?
They were wanting you to work on something else, if I remember properly. This idea.
No, not even that. No, I had a pretty good boss when I started at Atari. His name was Larry Kaplan, and he was one of the founders of Activision. But he did not want to manage programmers. He wanted to be a game designer. So he hired another guy to be the manager of all of us. And he made a pretty bad choice. He hired an older guy who just totally did not get video games. And this older guy, his name was George Simcock, heard. So there was this game, a text adventure game called, nowadays it's usually called Colossal Cave. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. That's, it's like go south, go west, go north.
Yeah, purely text. You type go north or pick up the bird or things like that, unlock the grate, and if you type the right thing, it would do it. You could explore this world, but it was all text. Each room was described by text. There were some objects you could pick up, and it would have a little short description of the object. So it was the network of rooms with objects and obstacles, and you could get past the obstacles by using the objects. Well, I played that text adventure game, and I decided I wanted to do that on the Atari 2600. And this new boss that I had, George, he heard that I was working on this, and he knew that the Atari 2600 had 4K of memory, and that Colossal Cave, the text adventure, ran on a mainframe that had 100K of memory. So he said, it's impossible. Don't work on it. And, he didn't ask me how I planned to do it. He just forbid me to work on it. And so what I did, I was kind of headstrong, stubborn guy. It's kind of a character. I'm from Missouri in the United States. It's stubborn as a Missouri mule is a phrase you hear sometimes. So I had no respect for this guy. He forbid me to do it without asking me how I planned to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. So I just worked on it in secret, and I decided I could pretty quickly make a feasibility demonstration. And I worked very hard for 6 weeks, and I created the room-to-room motion. You know how it works, because you play adventure.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
I've on the edge of the screen. And I came up with the idea of putting walls around the edge of the screen with some holes in the walls so that those would be doors that showed you where the exits were in rooms. And I had two or three objects that you could pick up and move around. I had one dragon that would chase you around. And he could even chase you from room to room. I had that working in the 6 weeks. But when the dragon caught you, nothing happened. So that clearly wasn't good enough, but it was good enough for a feasibility demonstration, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I had two other objects. I think one of them was a chalice. It didn't do anything. You couldn't win the game, but it was an object you'd pick up. And there was a third object. I forget what it was. So one dragon, one chalice that did nothing, and some other object, and about eight rooms. that you could move from room to room. Well, that was enough to show that it was possible to make a graphical adventure game on 2600. And at that point, I showed it to George. I thought he would say, oh, yeah, I guess you can. I'd only use a third of the memory. I only use a third of the 4K to make that feasibility demonstration. I thought he would say, well, I guess I was wrong. It is possible on the 2600. But what actually happened was he got mad that I had not followed his orders. I was really demoralized by this.
I mean, you have proven the guy wrong.
Yes. And I had one game under my belt at that point, which is Slot Racers. It was released in the fall of 1978, right before Christmas, 78.
Yep.
Just done one game. And I thought, I got excited about, after I played the text adventure, I got excited about the idea of doing a graphical version of that. I thought it had possibilities. That's the same reason I took the job at Atari. I thought it had possibilities. So I thought making a graphical version of this text adventure game had possibilities. At that sort of stage, you don't know what the possibilities are. It's kind of an intuition, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're working with a one-man band on it at this point as well. I imagine
isn't
really coming. It's you kind of got to motivate yourself to keep moving forward with it.
Well, that's right. There was until you have some sort of game working, there's nobody's going to give you any feedback. There's no game.
Yeah.
So the fact that I had this idea, I was excited about it. I made a working prototype of a very simple version of it, which disproved what George said, that it was impossible. And then he's mad because I disobeyed him. That was very demoralizing. So I went on vacation for a month. And so they had me talk to the HR person. She says, well, we don't hold jobs at Atari. And I went anyway. I'm not the world's greatest employee. If you want an employee who does what he's told to do, I am not that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And I'm the kind of employee that does something better than what he's asked to. And you know what I've learned? There's some bosses that like that kind of employee, and there are other bosses that hate that kind of employee.
Yeah.
Because if you do something better than what he asks you to do, he can't take credit for it. That's one type of boss. And there's a better type of boss that sees the big picture, and when you come up with something better than what he asks you to do, he's happy. So that's, you know, live and learn. George was not the better type of boss. He was the kind of boss that was mad that I didn't do what he told me to do. I went on vacation for a month. Didn't know if I'd have a job when I got back, but I did. And I was kind of refreshed after a month back in Missouri and saw my family. And so then I just, well, I don't know. So I keep telling you the story of adventure.
And that's where we'll be leaving the first part of our chat with Warren. We'll be back again with part two, where Warren goes on a very, very deep dive into adventure, Atari, and tells us some great stories. One of the things you'll learn about Warren very quickly, this is the guy who pulls no punches and he tells it exactly as it is. So we've got some great episodes coming your way. Now, you can find us on Twitter at The Retro Project Pod. You can find us on Facebook at The Retro Project Pod. Or you can send us an email to theretroprojectpod@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. We'd love to hear any feedback that you have. And if you'd like to leave us a review on iTunes, please do. Reviews go a long way to helping out the show. So until next time, thanks for listening, and this has been the Retro Project Podcast.